Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's T3 Forum, Transportation Technology and Trends. The T3 Forum is hosted by Minnesota GuideStar in collaboration with SRF Consulting Group. My name is Eric Mingy with SRF Consulting, and I will be the moderator today. The purpose of the T3 Forums is to share knowledge and information on the emerging world of connected and automated vehicles. But beyond that, we're looking at other emerging trends in transportation as well. These forums seek to educate, provide an opportunity for asking questions, and provide a forum where we can all learn from each other. The intended audience are technical experts in the field of transportation engineering, as well as others in local agencies such as cities and counties. We'll be hearing today from representatives from Minnesota Department of Transportation, Federal Highway Administration, and then our feature topic, which will be dockless scooters with experiences from the city of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Bird, a scooter vendor. I'm going to go ahead and moderate this by introducing the speakers first. I'll run through all the speaker introductions and then follow that up with handing it off to our speakers in order. Our first speaker is Jay Hippus with the Minnesota DOT. Jay is director of the Office of Connected and Automated Vehicles. In this role, he leads the statewide policy research and deployment of CAV technology. Jay has degrees in transportation through the University of Minnesota. Our next speaker is Jim McCarthy with the Federal Highway Administration. At the FHWA, Jim works on ITS deployments in Minnesota, such as managed lane projects and connected vehicle operational tests. Jim has degrees in engineering from the University of Minnesota and is active on the board of ITS Minnesota, NCITE, and Minnesota GuideStar. We've got three speakers that will be discussing dockless scooters, beginning with Josh Johnson at the City of Minneapolis. Josh serves as the Advanced Mobility Manager in the Department of Public Works. In this role, he focuses on emerging mobility planning, operations, and policy, including shared, electric, connected, and automated vehicles. Prior to joining the city, Josh was General Manager for Car2Go, and he has a degree in business management. Our next speaker is Ruben Collins with the City of St. Paul. Ruben's been a transportation engineer and planner with the city for 6 years, and prior to that worked in the private sector. His responsibilities include managing the walking, biking, sidewalk, and transportation planning programs. Ruben has a master's degree in civil engineering and urban and regional planning from the U of M. He lives in Minneapolis and wishes he could ride an electric scooter to work. Our final speaker is Sam Reed with the private sector. He's from Bird Rides, where he's the director of government partnerships for the central region. Sam oversees government partnerships for Bird, the last mile electric vehicle sharing solution, bringing low cost, environmentally friendly transportation alternatives to communities across the world. Sam is a former staff attorney to U.S. Congressman Jim Cooper. At this point, I'm going to hand it over to Jay with MnDOT.
Thank you. One of the biggest things we're working at MnDOT right now is the governor issued an executive order back in March, and we have about 30 days to get the report done. So the report is basically identifying changes in statutes, rules, and policies on a variety of different topics. We're also working closely with our DPS sections on how we can actually look at our existing laws right now to allow some more testing before actual regulations are passed. So over the past several months, we've been working with a bunch of different stakeholders. We've actually had 8 different subcommittees that have been looking at all these different aspects. And you'll see in the report on December 1st, there'll be recommendations about 5 to 10 recommendations on each one of these different groups. For example, infrastructure, there'll be specific recommendations about how we need to fund the infrastructure and what infrastructure advances we should be making. Some of those will include fiber optic communications, upgrading signal systems, better pavement markings. But these will all be kind of pulled together in that final report. Since we had so many different groups and so many different recommendations, we looked at the advisory council and said we probably shouldn't present 300 recommendations to the governor and the legislature. So we boiled it down to common themes across all the different groups. And these are going to be the 5 primary recommendations. We're still tweaking these a little bit. The advisory council just saw these yesterday at our one of our last meetings. But basically, the main pieces are going to be funding. Funding will actually drop down the list a little bit. We don't want to ask for funding right off the bat. But basically, we need funding for how can we prepare our infrastructure, conduct pilot projects, conduct research, get our cybersecurity measures ready to go, driver training, and workforce training. We also thought it was very important for the legislature to talk about clear policy. Right now, 29 states actually have legislation, and Minnesota has nothing. So we basically need to have the legislature authorize the safe testing and deployment of automated vehicles. And we're also asking them to do that with and without human drivers present. So it's kind of a big step. Also authorizing the DOT and public safety to partner together to come up with what those programs would look like. We don't want everything to be in statute. We want to have the flexibility for the agencies to actually do some of that work behind the scene. And then working closely with our local agencies and allowing local governments to kind of allow some innovation. Those are really kind of the innovation tanks where a lot of this work can actually come forward. We also talked about partnerships is going to be very big in the future, how we can partner more between industry, government, and academia. Public education and outreach is also going to be a huge theme, providing more opportunities for the public to feel and touch and see the vehicles. And then leadership. We need to continue on with these leadership efforts and have more forums for us to get together and talk about some of the challenges that all of us face with implementing this, continuing with a similar advisory council, and then continuing with our interagency teams and expanding that to include local units of government and tribal governments. So those are the kind of the five primary recommendations. And say they're still being massaged, but that report will be available on December 1st on our website. And we'll make sure we get it out to this group too. Just an update quickly on MnDOT is doing a strategic plan. So the advisory council report kind of covers the whole entire state and how the state should work. And at MnDOT, we're actually focusing on what we should actually do to prepare MnDOT. And there's some great tools in here that I think our partners can use, our consultants can use, our local units of governments can use, and our public, our other private industries can use on how MnDOT is going to be preparing. And this is just a list of different things that we're looking at. We're looking at our long-range 20-year plan and doing some scenario planning. And the big need we're looking at for is those capital needs. So as MnDOT's deciding how to be strategic in our investments, we can share those with the industry and give them some different ideas and perspectives too. This report will have some kind of draft recommendations by the time the next governor comes on board and our new commissioner, but the final plan will be done around March or so. For connected vehicles, we're actually really excited. We have our Highway 55 connected corridor. So this is going to be one of the first corridors in the country that's going to actually be cyber secure, where actually a production car could actually use the technology. So basically from downtown Minneapolis, the edge of downtown Minneapolis, out to 494 along Highway 55, 22 signal systems are currently being outfitted with SPAT, signal phasing and timing technology, broadcasting that out through shortwave radio communications. We actually have a test demo that we're going to be attending next week to see how the technology is actually working. So we're hoping to actually get a GM or a Toyota car. We can actually run through the corridor, and that vehicle will be able to read the signal phasing and timing. We also have this winter, one snowplow will be outfitted with signal priority. So as they're traveling down 55 late at night, they can make a call to the signal system and get priority to plow all the way through and improve our plowing operation. So we are just, say, getting the demos up and ready to go. And we'll have a lot more public demonstrations for this group to see once it's actually up and running. So the plan is next week, November 6th, is our first kind of dry run with a real live vehicle. And a big thing that we're actually working on, this is kind of brand new. It's called the Minnesota Cab Challenge. So we just issued an RFP on October 1st. It's the first of its kind in the state of Minnesota, where it's an open-ended RFP. And basically what we did is we said, industry, we want to use cab technologies, connected automated vehicle technologies, to solve our transportation challenges. And some of the things that we're concerned about are winter weather conditions, work zones, accessibility for all, how do we make sure our policies are set up. Some of those are the big pieces that we're looking at. So inside the RFP is a list of different things that we're concerned about. And basically the industry comes to us with an idea. Before they actually submit a proposal, they can meet with us one-on-one and kind of pitch an idea to us. And we can say, well, here's the risks and challenges we see with that proposal. Or we can say, yep, that proposal, you know, has some validity. We'd be interested in entertaining that proposal. So with the open-ended RFP, it's not a closed date. It's throughout the whole entire year. People can submit proposals at any time. And MnDOT will evaluate those proposals about every 2 months. We're not evaluating the proposals against each other. We're just kind of evaluating the proposals against a set of standard criteria. So if we like the proposal, we have three different options. We can say, yep, we're going to fund it now, or we may defer that funding until next fiscal year when there's more funding available. So it's really a unique opportunity. There's probably some opportunities in here to partner with our local agencies too. So we may have an idea that says we want to do something on a certain roadway, and we can actually partner with the local. So as those ideas come in, we'll be looking for those additional partnership opportunities. And then finally, I won't touch on this too much because I know Jim is going to talk on the NHTSA 3.0 guidance that recently came out. But for the local units of governments that are on the call, there's some really important things in here, and there's actually a section of the report that talks about what local unit governments can do. So it talks about testing on local streets and how to prepare for that. It talks about how you should be considering land use and curb space impacts in your planning methods. It talks about the increase in traffic and what that could do. It also talks about how to engage with citizens as this technology comes on board. So take a look at that. It is a kind of a lengthy document, but take a look at that section for the locals. There's a lot of great information in there. And then the federal government is looking for comments on this, and comments are due back on December 3rd, 2018. I know the state of Minnesota, our sister agencies at MnDOT are actually working on some comments right now. So if you want to submit your own comments or share your comments with us, we'd be happy to entertain those. And that's the short update from MnDOT for today. Thank you.
Great, Jay, thank you much. As Jim's working his way up to the front, I want to remind folks that we will have a round robin session at the end of the forum here. So if you have questions you want to pose to the group, please type them into the chat box on Skype, and we'll be monitoring those and running through those when we're done. So, Jim.
Right.
Thank you, Eric. Good to be here and talk about the CAB 3.0. Obviously, it's our third version, but every year now we're issuing new guidance on connected and automated vehicles. It's a fast-changing business, and we're learning a lot as we move along, but we need to put out guidance to try and stay ahead of the oncoming freight train of connected vehicles. The term guidance is a term of art in the federal government. It's not regulatory, it's not legal, but it is provides us direction and provides you ideas on how things should be done. I like to think of it as a set of voluntary standards for testing and deployment. CAB 3.0 is a large document, 57 pages. It's very philosophical and expansive, and it's pretty readable, actually, for a guidance document. It both provides direction on what you should be doing and provides a look into where we think the legal regulatory framework should go. A big change that's happening within this area of connected vehicles is what I call the fundamental issue is for 100 years, the federal government's been managing and regulating vehicles for driver safety, vehicle capabilities. We've learned a lot over that 100 years on how vehicles operate, what causes fatalities and injuries, how to make vehicles safer, things like airbags, front airbags, side airbags, automatic braking, all those things come out at NHTSA. So for 100 years, we managed a vehicle. And for that same 100 years, state DOTs have managed driver as far as driver regulations, driver requirements, testing, insurance, all the things that relate to the driver. And that's worked pretty well. All the state codes are based on what's called a uniform traffic code. So they're pretty similar, but they all have their unique applications. So what happens when there's no drivers? In fact, CAB 3.0 acknowledges that a vehicle can be the driver. There can be no one in that seat. What's the state's role then? Is the state supposed to manage a vehicle? Well, that's NHTSA's job. Is the state going to bleed it? State agency going to bleed into the federal role? Or will the federal, what you see a lot of discussion when this is happening, is called preemption. Will the federal government decide how this is going to be? And that's kind of the battle, that's kind of internal battle in this guidance is how's that play out? That of course, will be the legal action that will happen later. But right now, that's part of what took a while, along with some other things, for this to come out. It's an important issue that we've got to figure out how that's going to play out so we can start writing laws and regulations around that. So there's a number of principles. These are real guiding principles, and I'm only going to talk about these. There's also strategies, and then there's the stuff that Jay had talked about, more practical guidance type activities you can be working on. First is, this is very important to us, is the federal role is safety. We're in this because of safety. We wouldn't be spending money on it. We wouldn't really have an interest in it. NHTSA one, if it didn't have a safety implication. And we have high hopes with how this is going to improve safety. So that's, it's always important for us when we're going to write laws and regulations that we determine our federal role. Next, and you're going to hear this discussion at conference and stuff, but 5G is the future. That's going to take care of everything. Forget the stuff you already got tested, DSRC. I'm not sure where that's going to end up, but the guidance says we're neutral on what the communication equipment is. What's standardized is the communication protocols. So whatever system used to carry your message at the roadside, that message will be standard. So whatever you put out at the roadside should be able to read that message. So that's something we've been working on for 15, 20 years now, is figuring that out. We've been testing that for many years. We tested in 2009 up at Brainerd International and saw how all the different car companies can make that work together. We can read their data. So that's pretty well established. Another thing that's important here is we maintain the 5.9 gigahertz bandwidth at the safety channel we reserve for connected vehicles. That's being maintained. That was in debate to be sold off as other internet bandwidth. So that's important. Number four is kind of gets back to that fundamental question I mentioned earlier. And this, I'm reading this section right now, and it's pretty long. But, will promote regulatory consistency. I'm not exactly sure what that's going to mean in the future, but it's clear from the manufacturers they need consistency. They're interested in dealing with 50 states and 1,000 municipalities. They're looking for consistency. So how that plays out, we'll find out. That's going to have to be regulatory law. And lastly, is we will continue to fund and have a strong research and testing program at Federal Highway, more pilot projects, things like that. So be looking for announcements coming out. There's one right now on truck tuning. I expect more will come out probably next fiscal year, 2019. So that's it for my briefing. Thank you.
Great. So now we're going to shift into the dockless scooter side of the presentation, and we'll start with Josh, representing the city of Minneapolis.
Thanks, Eric. So I'd like to just discuss kind of a brief overview of where we stand today, how our regulation and approach to scooters developed, and what the implications have been on our right-of-way, and then what we're going to look at for next steps. You'll note my pictures throughout the slide are of good behavior. I think Ruben has a few of the bad behavior slides, so I'll let him speak a little more to that. So, believe it or not, we actually anticipated scooters launch. We were in the middle of our process of getting our regulatory framework developed and through our council when Bird launched. It was actually the day of our public hearing for what we're calling our low power vehicle ordinance, which is based on the state statute. I'll get into that a little bit later, but as of today, Bird has 200 scooters on Minneapolis right-of-way. Lime, the other scooter company, also has 200 scooters on Minneapolis right-of-way. They also both have a pilot at the U of M where they have now 100 scooters each. There is the possibility that those scooters could be ridden out to, say, Minneapolis right-of-way. So day-to-day basis, we'd likely have somewhere between 500 and 600 scooters on our streets. As of Monday, I guess, we're at about 180,000 rides for both companies. 35% of those rides have been new users, 6+ rides per scooter per day, an average of 1.4 miles per ride and 13 minutes per ride. I'll also say anecdotally, I've seen a wide variety of users. I think there's kind of an assumption that this is more for young white males and not necessarily everyone else. That's kind of a general assumption about shared mobility, but I have seen quite a variety of people riding, from women in heels to older gentlemen in business suits. So I think this speaks to kind of a new development in shared mobility and how it's able to cater to a wider variety of people and provide a transportation solution that is comfortable for all ages and most abilities. So with regard to the regulation, we based it on state statute, which actually existed already going all the way back to 2006. And that was with regard to personal motorized foot scooters. They didn't anticipate shared scooters back then. But the definition in the state statute is pretty close to what we actually see on the street. Has handlebars, can be stood or sat on by the operator, powered by internal combustion or electric motor. Wheels no more than 12 inches in diameter and capable of max speed not more than 15 miles per hour. There's also a separate piece of the statute that defines their operations. So they may not operate on the sidewalk except to cross it. They may not be operated with a passenger. There is not a requirement to wear a helmet unless you're under the age of 18. Both companies also have a minimum age of 18. And generally, they're treated as bicycles. So may operate on a bike path, lane, or trail, or bikeway, essentially unless signed otherwise. Now, with that being said, if you've been in Minneapolis or St. Paul, you've likely seen multiple people not abiding by those rules, and we've been kind of leaving that up to both companies to monitor and regulate themselves. I'll speak to that in a minute. So with the city regulation that we developed based on that state statute, we started with a low-power vehicle ordinance, and the intention there is to anticipate the possibility of other modes that we don't have yet but may come about. So shared skateboards, unicycles, flying drones, whatever that may be, might be able to fit into this regulatory framework where we have kind of some broader policy around what you need to operate that shared system, so a license agreement to start with, and then includes provisions for enforcement of those low-power vehicles. And then within that, we have the specific terms of the operations in the license agreement. So for each scooter company and for the purposes of this pilot, we set it up as a four-month term, August through November. Operators had to submit an application to be considered, so that's where we really got into how they would be operating, what their experience was, what kind of service area, maintenance practices, hiring practices, and really dug into who they were as a company and how they might fit with our goals for the pilot. With regard to the actual specifics of the license agreement, maxing 200 scooters in the first 2 months, so total in the city, 100 each company, and then 400 in the final 2 months, again, total, so 200 to each company. And that can be increased or decreased by the public works director at any time for really any reason. And we established a $20 fee per scooter, which also includes an optional $1 per scooter per day. That's something that BIRD is chipping in as part of their Save Our Sidewalks pledge. Essentially, the intention is to provide additional funding for kind of shared infrastructure that benefits not only the city, but also BIRD and its riders. As far as the right-of-way implications go, we require that scooters be parked upright using a kickstand in the license agreement. They must be parked in the furnishing zone of the sidewalk, so you likely know that term, but generally where meters, street trees, benches, other street furnishings are, that's where we're asking them to park scooter, or requiring them to park scooters. They may not impede the pedestrian path of travel or access. Geofencing can be required if we deem it necessary, so if we want to collect scooters in a certain place, we could set up a geofence, or if we want to prevent scooters from being parked or ridden in a certain place, we could also have the ability to do that. We've only taken that into consideration in one case with repeated complaints. Otherwise, we haven't seen that as a needed requirement. Operators are also required to maintain ongoing education for proper parking and riding behavior of their users. So that's taken a few forms. One is a tutorial that they have in their app. We've also asked both companies to kind of develop a comprehensive safety campaign that's included kind of some email blasts on appropriate or reminders of appropriate behavior. They've also done some stuff on social media. The two graphics you see on this slide are some that we've come up with. We created a scooter page on the city's website where these are visible, and we've also put that out on the city's social media channels. We're also using 311 to track the number, nature, and location of complaints, and that's going to inform how we're able to, or how, what decisions we make as far as regulation and enforcement go, not only this year, but also going forward. And so next steps, we're going to look at the right-of-way impacts, so what kind of accessibility and pedestrian interaction implications are there from this. So how often do we see scooters obstructing the pedestrian path of travel, knocked over on the sidewalk in the streets, broken, all those kind of things. We're also looking at implications for how they interact with bikes and cars as well, user operational and parking behavior, and then infrastructure implications. So based on scooter use so far, what is this doing to change our decisions on planning and building out our bike network? And whether or not bikers like it or not, scooters have definitely very quickly advanced that conversation. It should have been happening sooner than this, but scooters have definitely elevated that conversation. And then we're also looking at how equitable the scooters are. So in terms of the service area where scooters are being distributed, and also what kind of pricing and operational barriers are put in place for keeping this from being a solution for all and not just some. And then whether or not this is a viable alternative or novelty as a mode choice. And so one of the things we're really interested in and going to use a few modes to accomplish is via survey and then also data on trip and rider usage. We're trying to understand, is this going to be a meaningful mode choice, or are people going to revert back to personal vehicles once it's dark, once there's bad weather, or once we require the scooters to be pulled off at the end of the year? So that's one thing we're really looking at over the winter, and then determine how to introduce back in 2019.
Great, thanks, Josh. A lot of interesting stuff going on there with the city. And a reminder to keep sending in your questions on the chat feature, and we'll be getting to those at the end. And Ruben, you're up.
Great, thank you. My name is Ruben Collins. I'm with the City of St. Paul Department of Public Works. I'm a transportation engineer and planner there. The initial rollout, I want to talk a little bit about the initial rollout of scooters in St. Paul, and this is a similar story that you probably read about in the newspaper. We showed up to work on July 10th, and there were bird scooters on the ground, and we had no prior notice of that, and no permission granted by the city for those scooters to be in the public right-of-way. We had no framework to govern those. And had no contact with the company prior to that happening. And so that put a lot of wheels in motion. At this time, we have been talking a lot about shared bicycles, so we had some internal framework of how we were going to be dealing with bicycles that did allow us to pretty quickly pivot and apply those to scooters. But it did really take us by surprise. Shortly after the mayor asked that the scooter company remove those scooters from the scooter company declined to do that. So we did not get off on the right foot, but it did force the city, or encourage the city, to very quickly create some sort of framework to manage scooters. It was, as soon as those scooters showed up on the street, they were instantly very popular, and we started hearing a lot of feedback from people, especially people who I think initially were using the scooters kind of recreationally, and then shortly thereafter, I think people started to find them useful for education purposes. But what we heard day one was, wow, these scooters are a lot of fun. We should find a way to keep these in the city in a way that makes it safe for everyone. So shortly thereafter, City Council approved this pilot program, and we currently have contracts with both Lime and Bird to operate scooter programs in the city. It's a pilot program, so it's 4 months long, August to November. The program is open to an unlimited number of vendors. We don't limit the number of vendors who are able to participate, but we've only had the two companies take us up on that so far. Each vendor is allowed up to 150 scooters. They can have more if they request permission. And the vendor had to agree to a predefined contract term. So when the vendors came to us, it was not a negotiation process. We presented them with a contract and said, here's the terms. Take them out. Josh already mentioned the statutes that govern scooters. We required the vendors to have a 24-hour customer service hotline. This was initially something that was important to us because we wanted the scooter companies to be accountable for the scooters that they were placing in a right-of-way, and this was one way for us to do that. This also shows a little bit, to be candid, this shows our lack of understanding about how the scooter companies operate. It's just generally the scooter companies are not operating 24 hours a day. We did not know that. And so that shows just kind of how new this was to us, and how much it kind of took us by surprise. Improperly parked scooters is something that is one of the biggest issues to talk about. This is a picture of a scooter parked right in front of a door, and I watched this scooter for about 10 minutes yesterday, actually. And so many people went in and out this door. This is right off the Green Line Transitway. And you can see that door on the right can't even fully open before it hits the scooter, and so many people were still using that door. And this is not what we want to see, so we need to figure out how to keep this from happening. But the contract is very specific about where scooters can be parked, how they need to be parked, very clear that it's the vendor's responsibility, not the city's, to make sure that the scooters are all parked correctly. It has some pretty specific language in it about how quickly the scooter companies have to respond if we report that a scooter is improperly parked. And also some language about if the scooter companies do not respond, city staff will address the parking situation, and we will seek reimbursement from the scooter companies for those costs. To date, we have not had to do that. The city has not moved any scooters and sought reimbursement, but the contract allows us to do that if we need to. We had a lot of conversation about equity and the service zone. In St. Paul, the vendors can deploy their scooters however they want throughout the city, so we don't have specific language about where those scooters have to be staged every morning for use, but we do require that those scooters are allowed to serve the entire city. So someone that rents a scooter can ride it to any corner of the city and end their ride anywhere in the city. moving forward, I think the next step is to talk more about coverage and make sure that the scooters are effectively covering the city. Generally, what we see on a daily basis is those scooter companies are really loading up the downtown area, and the outskirts are not being as well served. The payment system, the scooter companies pay the city $1 per scooter per day, and that's payable monthly. We get a monthly check from the scooter companies for that ability to operate in the public right-of-way. One challenge we've had is $1 per scooter per day. We don't know exactly how many scooters are out there on a daily basis, and so that becomes a challenge for us to for this payment system. We really rely on them to tell us how many scooters they have in our public right-of-way. And we certainly don't have any reason to believe that the scooter companies are, you know, misreporting that information, but it's still not a great scenario if we can't verify how many scooters are actually out there. To that end, where are the scooters? And that has been a challenge. We have specific contract language that says the vendors must provide the city with an electronic method of visualizing the location and distribution of scooters in real time. Essentially, you know, we want the vendors to provide us with a map that we can access that says here's where the scooters are. Neither of the vendors that are operating in St. Paul have actually provided that. That is something we'll have to work through. And to a certain extent, I think it makes it challenging for us to manage the system. So, for example, we get a complaint that says there's a scooter parked, you know, in a really inappropriate location in the middle of a park where there's not supposed to be a scooter. We don't have a way of pulling up a map and saying, yes, we see that scooter is there. We report that to the company and ask them to move it within a certain amount of time. We don't have a reliable way of verifying that it has been moved within a certain amount of time. And so it has been an ongoing challenge. The scooters are required to provide monthly reports to the city. I won't read this list, but it's a fairly long list of information that we require the scooters companies to provide us each month. And I'll touch a little bit on sidewalk clutter. This picture is not from the city of St. Paul, but I think this is kind of everyone's fear about scooter use in the city. What happens when we get situations like this where there's just kind of a pile of scooters on the ground blocking the sidewalk? Or even just one scooter can cause a serious challenge for people with visual impairments or people in wheelchairs or anything like that. It's blocking the sidewalk. One thing we've tried to do in St. Paul is things like this, a little bit of perspective. This is another picture from the city of St. Paul. Also something, not scooter related, but it's something that is a serious challenge for pedestrians. If you're walking and you find a sidewalk closed and there's a picture of a pedestrian that is now walking in the street because the sidewalk was closed. Here's another challenge. Plowing sidewalks, streets without sidewalks. This is a popular bar in St. Paul where there's been a long-standing practice of the patrons just parking right on the sidewalk. And there's been we do our best to enforce this, but it's just been a long-standing practice. And this is also a non-scooter related issue that is a major challenge for people using scooters. So when we think about the challenge that scooters potentially face for pedestrians, it is a big deal. We should pay a lot of attention to it. We should do our best to make sure that scooters are not impeding pedestrians. We also know that we have a lot of other issues in the city, a lot of other systems or practices that generally break, that occasionally break down for pedestrians. What that means for us internally is when we've tried to consider ways we could do more to enforce, to keep sidewalks clear, we want to try to find systems that are more encompassing than just the scooter issue. Yeah. When dockless scooters initially hit the streets, there was a fair amount of kind of backlash about the dockless systems in generally causing issues, and there was a corresponding backlash against that initial backlash on the internet of being a little snarky with this image saying the problem of dockless cars is that they impede people in wheelchairs. We've seen this, right? Cars that block pedestrian ramps. And so there are a lot, you know, scooters blocking sidewalks is a problem, but there are a lot of other things blocking sidewalks out there as well. And we should pay just as much attention. I guess just to summarize, the benefits that we've seen in St. Paul is people are loving the scooters. They are very popular, and I think they will be around for a while. And they're serving parts of the city that other shared mobility hasn't. We've had the docked Nice Ride system in St. Paul for many years, and it serves a very small geographic portion of the city. Scooters are serving doing a lot better at serving the whole city. And there's no cost to the city, so there's That's certainly an attractive feature. Again, the challenge is we're really unable to reliably know where the scooters are and how many there are out there, and really unable to know if the scooter companies are being proactive about keeping sidewalks clear and proactively addressing improperly parked scooters when we report them. The biggest issue we've seen is people riding the scooters on the sidewalk. As Josh mentioned, it's prohibited by state law, but we see a lot of sidewalk riding. And so there's education that needs to happen there, and possibly some enforcement needs to happen there. That's what we're working on. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Ruben. A lot of good information there. We're going to move on to Bird, and we've got Sam Reed on the phone.
I'm Sam Reed. I'm the Director of Government Partnerships for the Central Region for Bird. So what is Bird? So we are a last mile electric vehicle sharing solution. We're dedicated to bringing low cost, environmentally friendly transportation alternatives to communities all across the world. We're now in 100 markets across the world, including cities like Paris and Tel Aviv. We're in about 80 cities in the U.S. And our mission, we're looking to reduce traffic congestion and parking problems, which is obviously something that many, many cities face. We look at the 40% of car trips that are 2 miles or less, and these are the trips that we're looking to replace with a more efficient mode of getting around that doesn't clog the streets. So Bird, we're helping cities, we believe, and you know, again, we're affordable, much more so than an Uber or a Lyft. It doesn't cost cities anything to implement, and we're affordable for our riders. We're $1 to start a ride and 20 cents a minute after. Your average Bird ride in the Twin Cities area is about 1.4 miles, and that costs you anywhere from, you know, $2.50 to $4 for that ride. We're also helping reduce carbon emissions in cities because we're 100% electric. So far in our 112-ish days in Twin Cities, we've removed over 140,000 pounds of CO2 emissions on the more than 100,000 car rides that we've avoided by people choosing to ride a Bird over a car. Like I said, its average is 1.4 miles, so that's a real car trip or an Uber ride that's being replaced, which is obviously helping to unclog streets and reduce parking problems. So equitable access is really important to us here at Bird, and Josh and Ruben touched on this a little bit. We work with cities to place scooters in otherwise underserved zones and transit deserts. We also waive that initial dollar fee for active duty and veterans of the military and for folks in any kind of state or federal public assistance, just to ensure equitable access. So we also hire a Minnesota-based charger team comprised of locals that pick up birds every night so they don't clutter streets. We drop off birds in the morning in their nests at 7 a.m., shut them off around dark, and each scooter is removed from the street every night. We do a safety check, we recharge them, and again, this local charger team of local folks in the area can earn extra money, and we're on track to distribute over $1 million to Minnesotans in the first year of operations. Safety is our number one priority at Bird. We instruct riders to always wear a helmet. We've given away thousands nationwide. They're free through the app for anybody that requests them. Helmet gift from the University of Minnesota, and we'd love to do more, you know, in the coming weeks. We've announced more in the neighborhood of about 50,000 helmets in the U.S. to date. We provide regular, consistent safety education updates through our app, on social media, and coordinating with metro governments, universities. Particularly, you know, I was excited to see some of the stuff that Josh and Ruben shared of how the city is supporting our efforts here. And on the next slide, you'll see some of the things that we do in app. The scooters go 15 miles an hour max. We dial that down from 22 out of the box. We do that for safety reasons. We have to have we put instructions on the app of where you're supposed to ride, right? Following bike lanes, roads, staying off sidewalks is really key. Everybody now gets an alert on the front end every ride they make to stay off the sidewalks. Safety for us also means keeping the bike lanes clear. As has been discussed already, we require all users to take a picture of where they park before ending a ride. We give instructions to park neatly, no blocking of sidewalks, ramps, entrances to businesses, and we're also working with cities on designated parking zones. We've also committed to both it's in St. Paul that we'll remove any bird that's inappropriately parked within 2 hours. They're also 25 pounds, so they're easy to move should anyone need to move them. SOS Pledge, both Josh and Ruben touched on this. This is implemented a year ago, and it's at the heart of our business model. This is, you know, obviously, we remove the birds from the streets every day. We do smart scaling so that we're responding to demand so that birds aren't flooding the streets. And as is touched on, we also share $1 per day that we give back to cities to build on what is really already fantastic bike lane infrastructure in your area. And in our first year, we're on track to give out about $75,000 to the cities to improve bike lanes. And that's in addition to any permitting fees. This is the numbers, and obviously these were shared in sort of the individual cities, but this is for the overall program in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. 112 days of operation. We've had over 100,000 rides, 160,000 miles traveled. Again, CO2 emissions avoided. Next slide, you can see that summary there as to how we're having a positive impact on the environment. Last thing I'll touch on next is the technology. So part of the reason why I've been brought aboard at Bird, and I've only been here now officially about 3-4 weeks, is what we've recognized is that governments are our number one partner and what we need to do. And so we're shaping the technology now really to serve the needs of governments. And what's come up, you know, several times on the call, big issues, sidewalk riding and where these things are parked, right? The community mode is a feature that we rolled out this week. This enables anybody in the app to report bad parking today. And here in the next couple of weeks, we'll roll that out for folks being able to report bad riding, which is really key for us, because what happens a lot of times is we'll get that same picture of blocking the doorway, but we'll usually get it long after that bird has been moved. This will enable folks to report that in real time. Not only will we be able to address the issue, but we'll also be able to address it with the particular guilty rider instead of warnings. Slide previous was about sharing data with cities, and that was touched upon by both Josh and Ruben. And Ruben, I'm committed to making sure you get access to that dash so you can see all this stuff by the end of this week. But that's another key thing for us. Is sharing data with cities to help them plan their transportation networks accordingly. So I'll pause there. I think that was about my 8 minutes. And sorry for the technical issues, and happy to take any questions.
Great. Moving on to some questions. I've got several here. I'm going to start off with one for either Ruben or Josh, if you want to address, provide any advice that you would give other agencies, such as cities here in Minnesota, that would be considering dockless.
I can jump in. My primary recommendation would be when you're creating the terms of the contract, make sure you are thinking about exactly how how you will get the data to enforce that. So, for example, on the payment method, we said our contract says $1 per scooter per day. We didn't think far enough ahead to know that we don't know exactly how many scooters are out there, and that's not something the city can generate on our own. So thinking through those contracts and making sure that there aren't any terms in the contract that you are wholly dependent on the vendors to provide to you to be able to enforce.
Perfect. Yeah, and I'll just add, there's a lot of good information from NACTO. There's a specific user group on both bikes and scooters that I think has brought forward a lot of valuable both questions and concerns. And so if you can get connected to that user group through NACTO, I think you can find a lot of valuable information there, and that can help kind of inform decisions. And of course, you can certainly connect with either Ruben or myself, and we can provide some of our own feedback in that way. I'll also piggyback on Ruben's points. So I made sure as we were writing the agreement to put a lot of good requirements on data in there, with the understanding that I can't do anything to plug into Bird or Lime's API, essentially their direct data feed. I don't know how to do that, but I knew we needed to require it. And fortunately, I lucked into some people in our IT department that had some capacity to be able to build us our own internal dashboard. So we've been able to, it took some time, but we've been able to work through some of the challenges that Ruben's seen. But I would say, you know, to Ruben's point, not only anticipate what you're able to do, but also who's able to do that in your municipality or agency. If you do have staff capable, or if you would need to, you know, potentially rely on either company to bring those kind of dashboards forward. And I will say that both companies have been willing to work on data. There's been kind of a shift from previous when, you know, TNCs and car sharing were very resistant to share or even discuss their data. I think scooter companies have taken a much more open approach, at least to this point, with what they've been willing to share.
Okay, great. And I've got a question for you, Sam, kind of along those similar lines. Can you share any lessons learned or changes in practice that you've done with working with the City of St. Paul and in Minneapolis in this initial deployment?
Yeah, so lessons learned for us. I mean, we're learning all the time, and we've, you know, just in terms of where we've come. So at the beginning of the summer, when I was first engaged with Bird, we were in 7 cities in May, and we're now in over 100. So we are learning very fast. This was the summer of growth for us, and I think, you know, really understanding that in ways that are different than some other disruptors like Airbnb or an Uber or a Lyft. The truth is that we have to be in a very symbiotic relationship with local governments. And, you know, if we're not, it's very easy to shut us down. And so I think what we have recognized is that, you know, it's not rhetoric. We're centering our service around ensuring that we are being responsive to what I would describe as kind of the negative aspects of dockless technology, right? Sidewalk riding, parking, safety issues. These have to become paramount if we're going to, you know, really thrive and survive, right? So what, as both Taylor, as both Josh and Ruben have mentioned, you know, people do love the scooters, but if we can't integrate properly into existing transit systems, if we can't improve bike lane infrastructure and work with cities, you know, to address issues as they arise, you know, folks may decide that the upside isn't worth what the negative consequences are. So that's really what I think we've learned and the way that we're shaping our business going forward.
I guess you can maybe try and answer this one. I'm just curious what happens if someone takes a scooter outside the city limits. Is there anything that will shut that scooter down, or how does that work?
As far as I know, the scooters don't shut down in any way. I think this probably varies from scooter company to scooter company. But as far as I know, no, people just end their ride, and that's still an active scooter. I think some of the scooter vendors will allow a bike to be, or a scooter to be rented if it's outside of the service zone. Others won't.
I think really the only limitation is the battery range. Generally, I think they're between 20 and 30 miles fully charged, so it depends on how far you're going out the zone and how far or how you plan to come back, whether it's on that scooter or some other means.
Anything else?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the only limitation is the battery life. The fact is if it's driven far away, and I've seen scooter rides at like 14 miles or more before. Our chargers love that because the higher, the farther away from the city center that the bird ends up, the higher the bounty is on that particular scooter. So chargers like to go pick up a bird that's far away.
Yeah, that's a good perspective. I hadn't thought of that side. I think we'll go down to our last question then. And that's a question for you, Jay. And just wondering if you could talk about, besides this forum, how is MnDOT interacting with cities and counties on CAV implementation and capturing ideas?
Yeah, good question. Mostly it's been through just kind of informal conversations that we've had with the cities and counties. We're trying to get out more to any conferences that they attend. On the county side, there's a little bit more interaction going on. The County Engineers Association is going to revive a technology committee that's going to help kind of coordinate the county efforts, and then we'll have one spot to go to coordinate with the counties, which will really help us. The city side is a little bit more challenging. Primarily, we've been working with just Minneapolis and a few other cities that have kind of expressed some interest in CAB. But that's one thing that we really want to figure out is how can we touch base more with the cities. So if anybody has any great suggestions, we're open to those conversations.
Okay. Well, we're going to wrap up now. We'll have our next forum in January, so stay tuned for a Save the Date announcement and the agenda to be forthcoming. Thanks, everyone, for participating. It's a great dialogue and chance to share information. So have a great day.